with 22-2092, United States v. Warner.
May it please the court, counsel, Chief Judge Holmes. My name is Joel Myers. I have the privilege of representing Charles Warner before this court this morning. I'll try to reserve approximately 2 minutes for rebuttal. On October 28, 2019, Charles Warner was not in the business of selling firearms. And under the very unique circumstances of this case, he believed that he was permitted to possess the firearms he did have. And finally, based upon the then operative definition of frame and receiver, the property that he did possess was not properly classified as a frame or receiver, and therefore not a firearm.
Well, the 25.
You can see
there were 14.
I certainly can see that, right. Judge Bachrach. I'm sorry. Yes.
That's all right.
The 67, I think, that Ms. Eisenbeis had evaluated, 66 of those she claimed were frames and receivers. It's my position and Mr. Warner's position that they were not frames and receivers because they did not meet the operative definition at the time of frame and receiver. Certainly, this morning I concede again, as I must, that the court's recent decision, Vincent v. Garland, does undermine a significant portion of the argument that I presented in my brief. While I'm not abandoning the argument, I'm not going to spend time arguing that today. But contrary to the United States' claim, however...
I won't press the abandonment, but what do you think is left of that claim after Vincent versus Garland? I mean, what is there remaining on that claim?
As far as before the 10th Circuit, I don't believe anything, Judge.
Okay.
What I meant to say is I don't abandon the strength of the argument. However, I certainly recognize this court has ruled against it. I'm hopeful and anticipate the Supreme Court will take that up later, given the circuit's
okay.
Issue. But I don't want to waste the court's time arguing, because I think the people in that probably did a much better job than I would do anyway. But contrary to the United States claim, I don't believe, and even though this court, 10th Circuit, disfavors as-applied challenges, I don't believe Vincent v. Garland eliminates the whole notion of an as-applied challenge to Mr. Warner. I think it was a much broader decision as applied to all nonviolent felons. I'm here today arguing that, as for Mr. Warner is concerned, the unique circumstances of his case distinguish him from that. I think as applied to him, the 922G prohibition is unconstitutional. So in that regard, allow me to discuss the unique features of Mr. Warner's case. Starting with every interaction that he had with the court before Judge Johnson, a judge in that case, a state judge, South Carolina as well as New Mexico, allowed Mr. Warner to continue to possess firearms, despite in the first instance being convicted of a felony in South Carolina. He was actually allowed to keep the firearm, provided he made restitution to the victim in that case. Fast forward a number of years to New Mexico, where Mr. Warner, I certainly concede, pleaded guilty to felon in possession of a firearm for a state judge in New Mexico. And perversely, as it may seem, and shocking as it may seem, the judge in that case actually allowed Mr. Warner to continue to possess firearms, albeit with certain restrictions in the course of his business. Just on those base facts alone, I think, you know, would certainly lead someone to conclude that going forward, they might not be prohibited by possessing firearms.
But well, and so your position is that he knew that the South Carolina conviction was punishable by a year or more in prison, but he was led to believe that the existence of a potential punishment in excess of a year would not have precluded him from possessing a firearm.
I'll answer it this way, Judge. He certainly knew that he had been convicted of a felony, so in that case, a crime potentially punishable in excess of a year. As you know, I'll argue a little bit later with respect to these court's decisions in Heisey and Hilleland, he didn't actually face prison time. So as far as the as-applied challenge, again, is concerned with respect to Mr. Warner, since his probation terminated upon the payment of the fine in that case, he was never in a situation kind of like Mr. Heisey and Mr. Hilleland to potentially face incarceration.
I don't want to interrupt your the progression of your argument. You're going to discuss Heise a little bit later?
Oh, yes.
All right.
Okay. So let me go back to the unique features. First of all, he appears before two judges, pleads guilty to crimes, both felonies, one possession of a firearm by a felon, and they allow him to continue to possess firearms. Add to that the ammunition that was taken during the course of a search warrant that led to the felon in possession of a firearm in New Mexico, that ammunition was returned to him. I'll certainly candidly admit before the court that someone who is a felon is prohibited from possessing firearms or ammunition federally. I certainly admit that. However, for whatever reason, again, the Rio Rancho Police Department gave Mr. Warner ammunition back.
Well, and my recollection, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the ATF had given him notice that he shouldn't be in the business of dealing in firearms.
Correct.
Did they not?
Correct.
Well, they did that. He knew he was a felon. What more did he need? I don't care what the state did with him. Authorities had told him, stop doing it.
Understandably so. And I think that brings out the tension that he faced. And I will certainly concede that the ATF did notify him that he should not be in the business of selling firearms and he should stay away from that. I know that a key feature of the government's evidence was a letter that was written to him. He didn't acknowledge necessarily agreeing with the letter, but he did certainly acknowledge receipt of the letter, and that's what the letter says. Acknowledged, received by Charles Warner, and he certainly acknowledged that, and the letter said that you may be prosecuted. Not that you will be, you may be prosecuted.
And what more did he need? I mean, he doesn't have to agree with it. He just has to know that they're telling him, don't do it.
Okay.
And he knows he's a felon. I mean, what more does he need?
This went on for a number of years, and each time he was presented with any interaction with ATF or presented that letter, he never left in handcuffs. And he was told that you may be prosecuted. Yes, he skirted a fine line between this. But getting back to federal authorities for a moment, there was a theft of a firearm from Mr. Warner's home, which was across the street from the shop where he worked. Mr. Warner, the felon that he was, reported that to authorities, basically drawing attention to himself. Again, I think in support of a belief that he is not prohibited from possessing the firearms, albeit an incorrect belief now. I think standing here today, I can tell you that he is aware of that as well. But as far as federal authorities concerns, United States Park Police, a federal special agent similar to an ATF agent, certainly with a different scope, returned the firearm to him. So
why does it matter? Isn't this a classic mistake of law? He knew what the he knew that he, as you admitted, that he was a felon. His crime in South Carolina was punishable by over a year in prison. He may or may not have read 922G1. So maybe he was mistaken, but he knew the facts that would have triggered, as a matter of law, the applicability of the prohibition in 922G1.
Yeah, it's kind of
authority do you have? I'm sorry, it's a long question. So what authority do you have that a mistake of law about the applicability, maybe there's no promissory estoppel, is there?
No, and I think it's kind of like parsing the Rahif decision in a certain way, where Rahif states that the person needs to know they were in the class of people prohibited. Right. And I think the way it has been defined is that the felon class or the addict in possession class, that particular class. But I'm arguing, Judge, and trying to extend that he knew within that class, a felon, it's not every felon is prohibited from possessing a firearm. We know that there's certain exceptions, albeit small ones.
Yeah.
That Mr. Warner's knowledge of being in a class, although he knew he was a felon, he did not know that he was in the class of felons that were prohibited in possessing a firearm. I don't think it's an estoppel type question, but I think it's a very fine reading of what Rahif says, that they need to know they're in the class of people. And what Mr. Warner's knowledge, based upon things, and certainly Chief Judge Holmes, as you point out, contradictory information, right? I mean, I think there's a part that he's going to want to believe, obviously, the more favorable facts to him. But he is
what subclass did he believe he was a member of that would allow him to have a gun?
That his felony did not prohibit him from possessing a firearm.
because of the business regulation exception?
I would say that I don't think it's, admit, I don't believe that's my strongest argument, but that of felons, like Mr. Heise was a felon, right? Yet he was in a class of people who could not be convicted of 922G felon in possession offense. For Mr. Warner's unique circumstances, as they were, not having faced prison on the one predicate conviction that he had. I know I've talked about, too, the New Mexico conviction, but that did not serve as a predicate in this case because he received a conditional discharge, and that was dismissed upon his completion of probation. So the only predicate felony in this case was one of the South Carolina convictions. Again, I admit, as Mr. Warner admitted before the court, he had two convictions from South Carolina, but only one was the predicate. The government, I don't think, had the documentation and went back a very long way. But of that, since Mr. Warner did not face prison on the one predicate offense that he had, he believed he was in the class of felons that were not then prohibited from possessing firearms.
What I need to get clear on is, are what are the characteristics factually of this class that you're talking about? I mean, I want to try to understand this argument you're making for extending Rahib, but it surely can't be, oh, I'm special, you know, I haven't been arrested, so I don't need to, I'm not subject to a prosecution. If this argument is going to work, there need to be specific facts that he has knowledge of that indicate to him that he is not prosecutable.
I think the unique facts surrounding him, Judge, that he did not face prison time for his South Carolina conviction. But adding on, curiously enough, he was also not prohibited within the state of South Carolina, nor was he prohibited within the state of New Mexico. Had the federal 922G not existed, he would be permitted under state law to possess a firearm in New Mexico. He would also be permitted under state law in South Carolina to possess a firearm as well.
But those facts are not facts that are enumerated in the statute.
No,
that it's somehow
correct.
Another would alleviate the problem that he has. And I mean, it would seem to me that if this thing is going to work, you'd have to be able to point to something that he says, I thought, yes, I knew it was a felon. Statute says that. But I also knew the statute had this exception, and I thought I was in that exception.
Well, I would kind of turn it around slightly.
Okay.
In the sense that while he didn't think he had an exception, he didn't think he was part of the people that were prohibited. Not that he had an affirmative exception, but his belief that he was not prohibited based upon his unique factors, which I've mentioned.
Okay, and I want to be clear just for housekeeping purposes on this. As it relates to the constitutional challenge, the as-applied challenge, are you saying there is not something for us to do anymore on that? When we resolve this case, do we have an issue that we need to resolve?
I believe so, Judge. I believe that based upon the way the statute's been applied to Mr. Warner, who is a nonviolent felon who had been provided firearms by multiple judges, federal law enforcement agency is not prohibited in either state of domicile or the state of predicate conviction. I do believe that it is unconstitutional as applied to him, and also based upon the strength of the Heise and Hilleland decision.
Okay, so for Vincent versus Garland does not foreclose relief as the government suggested for your claim.
I believe that to be the case. Correct.
Okay.
I will quickly go on. I will not have any time for rebuttal. I just want to touch on the two other main points, the business of dealing in firearms. The requisite statute that he has to do is to be engaged in a livelihood with the purpose of running a business. The government's evidence, I think, is conspicuous only by its absence and what the proof lacks. We didn't hear from any customers. There were no bank records.
They have invoices. Invoices to customers.
There was one invoice that actually Mr. Warner was the one who said, I sold one firearm. So he admitted to selling one firearm, an antique gun, as well as, I guess, an incomplete sale, the other cover. Three, and that is an expansive view of this, is not the repetitive sales that are required by the statute. Selling your own, making occasional sales of your own personal items is permitted by statute. Finally, as to the sentencing argument is concerned, I think Ms. Eisenbaugh's testimony is quite clear. She was applying her own definition, giving Mr. Warner no notice of what a frame and receiver is, And curiously, for the first time on their answer brief, the government uses the current operative definition, which we're not here before the court to determine whether those, I see my time is.
Go ahead and finish your thought.
It's hard to finish my thought now, but I will do it very quickly. We're not here to decide whether those items meet the current frame and receiver definition. We're here to decide whether or not they met the at the time of his sentencing, as well as at the time of possession frame and receiver definition. I submit that it did not. I thank you all for the time, and I apologize. I have nothing left for rebuttal.
No, go ahead.
I just have one question, and I'm sorry. I know you're over time. You mentioned Heisey three times. The opening comment was that Mr. Warner knew that he in the South Carolina conviction triggered a punishment of 1 year or more. In Mr. Heisey's case, because of Kansas' unique statutory scheme, there was no argument, even as I recall, even to the panel by the government, that Mr. Heisey ever actually was exposed to any prison time, because Kansas has a very unique statutory scheme that he had mandatory probation. And that was, I think, as I recall, in Heisey, the entire rationale. There was no possibility. There obviously was a possibility that he would be subject, Mr. Warner would be subject to a year or more in prison. Isn't that a pretty sizable difference?
It is a big difference, but I think Heisey doesn't speak about kind of the hypothetical defendant. I think it focuses on the individual defendant. And here, Mr. Warner was sentenced. It says in the judgment that's, you know, part of the record here, PTUP, probation terminated upon payment. And that was that his sentence would be done as payment is made to the victim in this case. So once that was done, he himself did not. And I think that puts him in more of the Heisey and Hill land.
Okay.
That's
very helpful.
Thank you, Judge Pepper. Thank you, Chief Judge Holmes.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jamie Roybal on behalf of the United States. At the heart of this appeal is the question of whether or not Mr. Warner may possess firearms. And he raises that question to this court in many forms, but the answer to each of his challenges is no. Mr. Warner remains a prohibited person and cannot possess firearms. I heard Mr. Meyer say a number of times in his argument that there are unique circumstances as to Mr. Warner, and I would submit to the court that the only unique circumstance as to Mr. Warner is that he is a very talented gunsmith. And unfortunately for Mr. Warner, that is not a constitutional class that merits special treatment under the law. So first off, he is a convicted felon. Section 922G1 is constitutional as it applies to him. I do not think that there is a constitutional question left for this court to decide based on the Vincent decision last week. I think that that very squarely forecloses his constitutional claim. Next, the United States presented far more than sufficient evidence at trial to support his conviction for dealing in firearms without a license. And finally, the district court did find by preponderance of the evidence that he possessed more than 25 firearms for sentencing purposes. I'd like to begin my argument as to addressing the sufficiency claim first, unless the panel would like me to start elsewhere. Okay. Please. Of course, the standard of review that applies when dealing with the sufficiency challenges, this court does not weigh conflicting evidence or witness credibility. Those are issues that are specifically for the jury. And this court will reverse a conviction for insufficient evidence only when no reasonable jury could find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So I'd like to give you kind of the 10,000-foot overview of what the summary of the evidence was at trial. This was a unique case to try based on the felon in possession count, and it was not until Mr. Warner was subject to cross-examination that he admitted that he knew he was a felon. So a good deal of the evidence was really intertwined between the two counts. Did he know that he was a felon and couldn't possess guns? And then was he also a convicted felon who knew he was a convicted felon, who knew he couldn't possess guns, who was running a firearms business? And so I would start by pointing out the panel has already noted the letter from the ATF. It was called Notice of Prohibited Status. Mr. Warner read that letter on cross-exam at trial. He acknowledged that he received it at the time. It had his signature on it, and it was very clear, and he did not state at trial that any of it was unclear.
Well, on cross-examination, he acknowledged that he was a felon. Did he acknowledge that he knew he couldn't possess weapons?
He acknowledged that he knew he was a felon, and I think that Mr. Myers pointed out a lot of the confusion, which were facts we just had to overcome at trial about the state court judge and the Park Service agent and people who I think did cause some confusion as to whether or not he could possess guns. But what I would submit to Your Honor is that he definitely knew he was a felon because he couldn't be on the federal firearms license for the elite warrior business, which he was essentially running. He just wasn't running it on paper. So a good portion of our evidence at trial dealt with the history with elite warrior armament, including ATF's repeated involvement. And part of why elite warrior lost their business license is because of Mr. Warner's continued involvement with the business.
But on the question of whether he is a prohibited person and therefore cannot possess a firearm. I mean, arguably, he could say, yes, I can't participate in the business. Elite Warrior got in trouble because I was involved in the business, but I could still possess a firearm. And so I guess what I want you to focus on is what I understood his argument to be, which is your opposing counsel, an extension of Rahif to say that, yes, not every felon is subject to being convicted under 922G, and therefore I was aware of circumstances that would have led me to believe that I wasn't in the class of people that would have been subject to being convicted. What do we do with that argument?
And is Your Honor's question, what do you do with that argument as to Mr. Warner's claim today that he's not prohibited person under 922G, or at trial, Mr. Warner's assertion?
More specifically, what do we do with that argument as it relates to his mens rea for the offense? I mean, the idea that he knew he was in the class, where he would require a people that was subject to being prosecuted. And unlike the other, in some sense, the other prohibited, unlike some other classifications under that statute, a prohibited person, not every felon is subject to being convicted under 922G. Every drug user would be. How do we deal with the mens rea at the time he's convicted?
He acknowledged multiple times at trial, and I think there was a lot of evidence at trial separate from his own testimony to suggest that without question he knew he was a felon.
Well, the kind of felon that was subject to prosecution, because not every felon is subject to being prosecuted and convicted, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And thinking back to Mr. Warner's cross-examination and frankly his direct examination at trial, I didn't think I was the felon who was not subject to being prosecuted. It was everyone was so confusing to me. And so I just thought, and I don't even know that it was, I just thought that I could possess guns. It was, and so I still did possess guns, right? So the ATF is telling me, they send me this letter that I acknowledge is clear, and they tell me I can't possess guns, and they tell me I might be prosecuted, but they never arrest me when they come to our business. And so for that reason, I continued to possess guns. And a state court judge, even though I acknowledged in pleading guilty to this state felon in possession crime that I was necessarily a felon, that state court judge, for whatever reason, gave me guns back, so I still possessed them. So I didn't interpret Mr. Warner's testimony at trial, nor any of the other evidence, to say I thought I was the exception of people under 921 who couldn't possess guns. It was just that everyone was so confusing to me, and so I still did possess them. And I was very good at building them, and I was very good at selling them. And so for that reason, I am therefore the special felon that just should not be subject to felon dispossession statutes. And I think that much of that is still reflected in this appeal today. And so again, I would like to direct the court to the kind of overwhelming evidence that was presented at trial, separate from this kind of intertwined and very long history with the elite warrior business. We presented the jury with many, many invoices that Mr. Warner acknowledged on cross-examination that he had sold those firearms. And I think the strongest evidence we have were Mr. Warner's Facebook communications. So he acknowledged that after the business shut down, he continued to run the Elite Warrior Facebook page, which showed repeated sales. And it was still a business being run. It was run by him. And again, his language reflects not a one-off sale and not a personal collection. He uses language like standard production and deposits, call for inquiries, available for delivery, options available. Someone asked him on Facebook, are you guys quietly taking in work or just clearing the workload? And his answer was, both, question mark. Again, Mr. Warner's language when he spoke with the undercover agent, those recorded calls, which we've provided to the panel, he says things like, building and projects and spec sheets.
I was intrigued by that in your brief. Is your argument that he was using the lingo of a dealer suggestive that he was a dealer? I mean, using, you know, legal terms of art connoting the fact that or suggesting that someone is a lawyer? How does the use of technical lingo, how is that probative?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's probative because if someone was just selling a personal collection to say, you know, I have this gun as part of, this is my gun, I have had it for many years and I am just getting rid of it, I think that that's different from, telling the undercover agent, who he, of course, did not know was the undercover agent at the time, you know, our Elite Warrior business has closed, so all of these have become personal projects, you get me? And so there was a lot of kind of wink-wink going on throughout this case for a very long time. And again, I think that someone who is saying, or claiming this is a personal collection, and that was our burden to prove it was not a personal collection, I think we meant that. I think that saying things like, you know, I'm going to be designing this new firearm and accepting deposits for that, that really cuts against the idea that this was a personal collection. And again, we had to show repeated natures of sales. We had to show that this was not just an isolated sale, and there were numerous instances in the record where we were able to show continuous and repeated sales. This was his business. Mr. Myers argued this at trial. He said, what you see on the table, because we had all, you know, 90-ish firearms out before the jury, was a man's life. And I think that that's really what this is about. Firearms have been at the center of Mr. Warner's life. The unfortunate reality for him is that he may not possess them under the law.
You said that you had to show repeated sales. How do we square that with how this case was charged? I mean, as being charged on one day. Is there a basis to show repeated sales based upon one day's activity? And what do you do with that?
Well, Your Honor, that is something that was argued at the district court level is Mr. Warner's argument was the government charged this as one day, so it's therefore a one-day crime. And I would disagree with that. We stated that on October the 28th of 2019, which is the day that Mr. Warner sold the firearm to the undercover agent, he was a dealer. And so, you know, the district court provided the definition of the dealer to the jury. That was jury instruction number 9. And that means any person engaged in the business of selling firearms at wholesale or retail. There's more to that. But I would say that what we alleged is that Mr. Warner had been engaged in selling firearms for a very long time, and he was doing that under the guise of the Elite Warrior when the business was licensed, and then when the business license was revoked, he continued to do that and just moved the inventory across the street to his house. So certainly somebody could have been a dealer on October the 28th and had taken that day off, so to speak. It's a status, I believe, as opposed to, you know, an action that had to be taken that day, although we did show that on that day he did sell a firearm to an undercover agent.
Well, okay, it's a status, but he was engaged in the business of dealing in firearms. So would the argument be that by virtue of his prior conduct, he had shown himself to occupy the status of dealer, and on that day, he was engaged in the activity that is consistent with that status?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's a fair characterization of our argument. So Mr. Myers attempted to have the district court exclude any evidence that was not specific to October the 28th. The district court did not do so and found that the invoices and the Facebook communications from 2018 and 2019 were relevant, and that's not an issue before this court today. And so, let me add this. I thought one of the unique arguments at trial was that, made on Mr. Warner's behalf, this wasn't a business because I wasn't profitable. But I think he acknowledged that the money was going to pay his bills. So there is no requirement under the law that the business be profitable in order for somebody to be engaged in the repeated business. I would like very quickly, if I could transition to the Heisey issue, as to whether or not Mr. Warner still remains a prohibited person. And I'm going to say two things about it. First off is that Heisey was published prior to our trial, and Mr. Warner could have asked the court to revisit that issue at any time before trial, and he failed to do so. And even if Mr. Warner's counsel did not read it, nothing prohibited him, at the time from raising the substance of the Heisey argument to the district court, and he failed to do so. So our view is that this is a new argument and the court should treat it as if it's waived. But if not, what I would say is that in Heisey, the key issue is that that defendant was mandated to be sentenced the way that he was based on the Kansas sentencing scheme. And the key issue here is that Mr. Warner, was eligible for more than a year of imprisonment. The Heisey inquiry is not what that specific defendant did receive, it's what they could have received. And so just because the South Carolina court chose not to sentence him to a term of imprisonment doesn't mean he wasn't an option. And I see that my time has expired.
I'm going to ask one question to make sure I understand your view on it. What do we do with this reference to frame or receiver and the suggestion that you're using a definition that didn't exist at the time?
Are you saying as to what we put in our brief, Your Honor?
Well, the allegation that you're using 478.12 did not exist at the time of his criminal conduct, and therefore that was not applicable, and that your use of that, yes, in the brief was inappropriate.
We noticed just last week when we were preparing the argument for this case that we included the new definition from the CFR and not the operable definition at the time, so I'm sorry about that. What I would say as to the sentencing issue, though, is I don't think it's fair to state that the expert witness at sentencing did not consider the CFR, or that the chief judge who sentenced Mr. Warner did not consider the CFR. So the court has Ms. Eisenbeis's report in the record, and you can see on the second or third page of her report that she lists the federal definition of firearm and the operable CFR at the time, which includes frame or receiver. And so I think that, you know, her findings as to each specific item that she reviewed are pretty extensive, and this court is able to review those. She noted markings on the firearms, key machining and drilling features as to each one that would make it qualify as a frame or receiver. And what I would say is that the chief judge was also aware of the legal definition of frame or receiver under the CFR, and he made a factual decision based on the expert testimony and having had the chance to view all of these items at trial that adjustment applied. And I think by a preponderance standard, that was a correct decision.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
A follow-up?
Of course.
I'm sorry to go over time, but I do want to ask a follow-up. Under the regulation, as I read it, to constitute a frame, it has to house the, quote, firing mechanism. The expert witness acknowledged that none of these additional guns, other than the 14, had any firearm control parts. Well, if they didn't have any firing control parts under the regulation, how could they have contained a firing mechanism? Even though he found by preponderance of the evidence, it seems to me that his finding is specifically contrary to the combination of the regulation and the expert witness's testimony.
I think that's a good question, Your Honor. And what I would point the court to is the portion of her testimony where she explained that the 1911-style pistol, which is primarily what Mr. Warner possessed, and that's what he was known to be making and manufacturing, had been known to the ATF for many, many years. So this was not necessarily a new firearm that was unfamiliar to them. So that's the first thing that I would say. And then the second, as to Your Honor's question, is Ms. Eisenbeis also explained that the CFR, encompassed many different types of options for firearms, and it wasn't necessarily to be treated as a checklist, that everything to qualify as a frame or receiver had to check every single part of the CFR. And so that's what I would submit.
Well, I don't want to belabor this, but are you saying that the regulation does not require to constitute a frame that it has to contain the firing mechanism?
No, I think that's what the CFR says, Your Honor.
And the expert witness said that none of these guns had a firearm control part, right?
So what she examined, and again, her reports in the record, are the unassembled frames. They had been serialized, and what she said is that they have not been properly destroyed to no longer qualify as a firearm, so to speak. So what she described, and I feel like I owe you an apology because I am not a gun expert, so I have a hard time articulating.
Well, you don't
owe
me. There's no requirement that you have to be a firearm expert. So.
Well, what she said is that these were essentially pieces that were ready to assemble that then the firearm could function.
I understand that it could be a ready to expel a projectile.
Right.
But that was an independent finding. The judge also found not only were these firearms, but they were also frames, and that's what I worry about. That there was a factually incorrect finding that tainted his findings to trigger the enhancement. But I don't want to belabor it.
Well,
I just
want
to make sure
I
understand it as best as I can.
What I would offer to the court is, we did the best we could at sentencing, and if this court feels that there's an error, we would welcome the opportunity to give that another try.
Okay.
Okay.
And I'm not suggesting that there was. I'm just trying to understand it, and that helps me tremendously. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll give you, if you want it, 3 minutes of rebuttal. You don't have to take it,
I won't eat up your free time.
I would. I wouldn't say no to the opportunity to do that, but I don't want to use it all. And I'll tender most of my time to the court. Wasn't as prepared to do it, but. Just a couple of comments that I had written down to myself. The crime was dealing in firearms without a license, not being a dealer at the time. The government made a conscious decision when to choose that. What happened with the undercover on that day was not even a sale of a firearm, and they actually admit that. That was the count that was dismissed. The only person who made a firearm on that day was the ATF. The government dismissed the count associated with the possession of a firearm on that day because it was not a firearm. It never proved the trial that it was a firearm. They only proved the trial one firearm, and that was the Kimber on the nightstand. They did not, contrary to Ms. Roybal's comment, show repeated sales. Repeated sales, to me, usually involve a buyer and a seller. We heard from one potential buyer, and that was an undercover agent, nobody else. And finally, I think kind of Mr. Warner's view was not that I am a special felon. It somewhat trivializes, I think, a lot of the facts that were laid before Mr. Warner. And this would be, I think, genuine confusion to an average person, that when judges tell you, albeit not federal judges such as yourself or Chief Judge Donson, but when judges allow you to do something, that you would be permitted to do so. With that, I'll tender the rest of my time to the court, unless the court has any questions for me.
Thank you.
Thank you for the extra time. Have a nice day.
Case is submitted.